I'm Joshua Uzi. I'm from Big Stone Gap, Virginia, and I'm black in Appalachia.
So as a naturalist, you know the soil, you know the ground, you know the plants and the animals, the patterns of weather, and you become comfortable in that place. You know that place. And then this reciprocity begins to happen.
What's up, podcasters? This is Dr. Nkesha Lamine, sociologist of race and place and Black Appalachian experiences.
And this is Pumpkin Star, your favorite guest host, your favorite land and place organizer, your baddie of the mountains, your baddie from Alabama up in these Tennessee mountains. We out here.
We out here, and Pumpkin is doing a roll.
I am body rolling right now.
Yes, y'all are listening to the Black and Appalachia podcast. What's up, Pumpkin?
What's up, Nkeshi?
Oh my God. Like, when you talk about reflecting on how much I enjoy doing this podcast sometimes, and it's because we get to hang out. Like, that's a huge part, is because we get to hang out and we get to be on the mics and just be ourselves. But I also enjoy getting to meet cool people.
Like who?
You know, of course, when I met Nikki Giovanni, it was like life changing. And then, you know, folks like Deesha Filia and others. Also, just like our folks, when we drive through communities and we get to meet our folks, or when we get to talk to like brilliant scholars in the region or across the country, Black people that are just smart just because, cool Black folks, just like cool ass Black people. Yeah. I enjoy that about
I love finding our people, you know what I mean? Like, and I definitely feel like this episode is like a moment when we found one of our people.
Indeed.
You know, like, I was just like, yo, we're vibing, let's talk forever.
I agree with you 100%. So we had a moment to fangirl a little bit and to vibe a little bit with somebody that I think we both kind of have been checking out. And I know for sure with the podcast, we've had our eyes on them. Just like, it'd be nice if we got to talk to this person. Earlier this year, the UT Humanities Center, in collaboration with Africana Studies and some other entities, including Black in Appalachia, hosted a Black Ecologies Week on campus. And by UT, I mean University of Tennessee, Knoxville. There were a number of events and programs hosted by different departments and organizations. There was a keynote lecture by Dr. Robert Bullard, who is considered a father of like environmental justice. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there are a bunch of community dialogues and other things. So we, and by we, I mean Black and Appalachia. The Black and Appalachia
Black
Day.
Showed out.
Yeah. The Black and Appalachia Day was probably the best day of all of this.
We
right?
did.
In our opinion. And we got to talk to like really cool folks. We had special guests. We had two special guests. And on this episode, we're talking about one of those guests. And then later on in the season, we'll talk about the other one.
Yep.
So our special guest, let's do a little drum roll.
Yeah. Dr. Drew Lanham.
Yes.
Shout out in South Carolina.
Yes.
Come through.
We've been, like I said, we've been wanting to talk to him for a long time.
Yes.
And if y'all are living under a rock somewhere and don't know who Drew Lanham is, he is the Black birder that you all have heard of, that you've seen all over the TVs and the internets and the podcasts. He's been featured everywhere.
Yeah, he's making ornithology dope. You
for
know,
like, sure.
I didn't know that term.
Right.
And now I like,
now
I hear,
we know all about it.
Ornithology? That's hot. That's like
part of your vocabulary,
right? You know what I mean?
Indeed, indeed. So we had a chance to talk to Dr. Drew Lanham. Lanham is not just a birder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely is a birder, but he's also an ecologist, a wildlife biologist.
Mm-hmm.
He's an award-nominated poet. The man has bars or words.
Bars and words and bars.
And he's an author. He's got two books that I know of. The first one was The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. And the other one was Sparrow Envy, Field Guide to Birds and Lesser Beasts.
And he's also just wonderful in space.
It was great. I mean, he is an academic. He's a professor at Clemson University.
Mm-hmm.
But our time with him was just kind of vibing. We had a good time. So obviously, as y'all can tell, we had a good time.
Yep.
We talked a lot. We vibed a lot. We said that like three times already.
Yeah. So So Black and Out Pledge is a live episode.
Yes.
And so I felt like we had an auditorium of people just watching us kick it.
Which is nice, right?
Yeah, we had a great conversation.
And so we're going to share some snippets of that great conversation with you all. All right, let's jump in, Pumpkin. Dr. Lanham, as you said just now, from South Carolina. He's actually from South Carolina Midlands, but he currently lives in the Appalachian region of South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Yep, there's Appalachian South Carolina too. And so we wanted to talk with him about South Carolina, Appalachia. But before we got into that, we took it back a little further because we both read his book, the memoir.
Yeah, The Home Place. It's wonderful. Place. If you haven't read it, please read it.
Very beautiful memoir. And so in that memoir, he shares a lot about his grandmother and sort of like his introduction to nature and birds mm-hmm. through her. And so that's where we started in our conversation.
You mentioned my grandmother, Mamatha. She was the first person I ever saw feed birds. She would take grits, usually Jim Dandy grits. I don't know why I remember that. At the time, I was probably jealous because I wasn't getting them. But she would take those grits out of the bag and she would throw them out in the backyard for the snowbirds, for juncos and sparrows, because she said she would pity those birds when it was cold. So that was a part of her ornithology, or her being afraid of owls because she said they were bad omen, and shooting a hole through the porch roof because she didn't want the owl in the arborvitae tree next to the house. Or if a bird got in the house, that meant death, right? And I didn't understand where that was coming. Y'all know how old that is. But then I started learning that parts of her ornithology were from her parents and their enslaved parents, but also there was indigenous culture that had mixed in there somewhere about some of this stuff. So that ornithology, I live daily. When I walk from my grandmother's house over to my parents across the pasture, you know, I would see what she called partridges, bobwhite quail, and all of these other birds, bee martins, which are eastern kingbirds. You know, that time in the space between my grandmother's house, which was a wonderful time, but it was also sort of wrought with sort of my grandmother's fundamentalism and sort of feeling closed in some ways. And then once I got to Mama and Daddy's house, I was going to have to share time and resources with my siblings, get beat up by them. And my parents were going to have stuff for me to do and expectations. So the time between leaving my grandmother's house and walking to my parents' house and back and forth, that was freedom. And the birds were the most free and you could always see them. So from the time that I could walk from Grandmamatha's house to Mom and Daddy's house and back and forth when I was probably 6-7 years old, that's when it took hold.
From this childhood experience that he was talking about, he grew up to not only love birds, but to see the parallels between their existence and ours. He said that birds represented freedom for him. And when we asked him what attracted him to birds, this is what he shared.
Flight and song, and both are representative of freedom and choice. In that way, I talk frequently. I have a friend, John Lane, down in Spartanburg. And we write about nature a lot, but for me, it always comes back down to birds. And birds are, they're not just metaphor, but they're allegory. I mean, for generations, our people, Black folks, have looked to the sky, but all people have looked to the sky for birds because here they are seemingly defying what keeps us bound to the ground. We understand that gravity is still acting on them, right? You know, as Jeff was picking me up, there was a flock of cedar waxwings that was flying from tree to tree. And those birds always stop me because they're, first of all, they're very social. They're always communicating. And if you stop and watch cedar waxwings, inevitably you're going to see one bird pass a piece of fruit or food item to another bird. And you can hear them always in conversation. But then those birds take off and they're together going to this next place. There's a certain comfort in that. Those birds are making decisions collectively, sharing resources, but going where it is that they choose to go. So that to me is a beautiful thing. I still try sometimes to be a bird. But what I do is with words that I write to try to sing in some way, with poetry to try to get others to fly. It helps me escape sort of harsh realities of life. And, you know, I've said, as I've written, that joy is the justice we give ourselves. So a bird is joy to me. As long as a bird can fly freely, sing, choose where it wants to be, and is not hampered by us, then that's joy. So that murmuration, you know, blackbirds are known most, at least in this country, for murmurations. And you can go on YouTube and other channels and you can see murmurations to music, right? And people cry. And then that bird close up has no legal protection. People can kill them without cause. Sound familiar? You can watch people play on a field, cheer them on, admire them for the prowess of their performance from afar, and then up close, you can't stand them. So there's also that parallel that has me interested in birds in these ways that we can see them and we can learn from them. Every bird that I see is sort of inspiration for some story.
So clearly this interest in birds is much deeper than just knowing the characteristics of the bird. And his understanding of birds is really intertwined with his understanding of the African-American experience, right? Yeah. And I can imagine that this particular orientation to birding, this way of knowing birds and of knowing nature, might be unique to him as a Black birder, right? Because as we know, there aren't many of them.
Yeah.
People told me when I learned what an ornithologist was, and decided that I wanted to be one, you know, people said, well, you know, Black people don't do that. Just like Black people don't live in the mountains. Just like Black people aren't cowboys. Just like Black people don't ride horses. They do.
So despite what they had to say, Drew did his thing and became a wildlife biologist, an ornithologist, and his pursuit of these studies brought him to Appalachia, particularly Appalachian South Carolina. I mean, real talk, through him, I was like, oh, yo, there's Appalachian right, South Carolina. Like, right. You know, so of course, we wanted to know more about his corner of Appalachia.
South Carolina is many things. From an ecological standpoint, we have this tiny sliver of the southern Appalachians that's the escarpment that, again, the Cherokee once called the Blue Wall. And so it's our smallest physiographic province. Maximum elevation is only about 3,600 feet at Sassafras Mountain. So we don't even get into spruce fir. See, if I'm going to go to war, I'm going to go to war with North Carolina to get some of their spruce fir and a few more ruffed grouse and golden winged warblers. But on the real, it's called the upcountry. But the old name for that portion of the state in Oconee, Pickens, Greenville, and a little bit of Spartanburg was called the Dark Corner. Now, the Better Business Bureau has changed that now in Oconee County. It's called the Golden Corner. But it was called the Dark Corner in part because that was the place where Scots-Irish primarily could escape, right? It was way above the fall line. There was very little industry there. People were living back in hollers and making do in that way. So yeah, it's on the edge of it, of Appalachia and the escarpment. But really, a lot of people in South Carolina don't know a whole lot about it. Our story is in some ways similar, but lesser known because it's on the edge. And because it's on the edge and not in the heart of Appalachia, it means that there are issues that get forgotten, including our presence in these places. So one of the most famous places, at least for Black folk in South Carolina, would be Little Liberia in Pickens County and Soapstone Church. So living in that narrow sliver and having that narrow narrative that even I am still learning about, like Soapstone or these other sort of small enclaves, Seneca, which is where we live. Seneca, South Carolina, is still classified as being in Appalachia. But then when it comes to Black folk in a place that people don't think we are or should be, then the narrative really gets narrow.
Like how complicated,
right?
It's like it's not even dualities. It's like you, it's a dynamic.
Yeah.
Being
Black in Appalachia.
Being Black in Appalachia. Right? Yeah. So like he talks about how there's this dynamic of like, okay, wait, so they are Blacks in
right.
Appalachia.
Right. So I end up in this place where I'm like, I'm not expecting to see Black folks.
Yeah.
But they're here. Uh-huh. And it's like, oh shit, we here, we everywhere.
Yeah.
But also
it's still
hella racist.
Hella racist.
And you come up on Sundown Towns.
And then there's Sundown Towns.
Exactly.
And I guess this episode's just about ratchet whites. Yet again.
You can count on them. All right.
This episode is not about ratchet whites. It's about birds. And Drew Lanham.
When I came to Clemson back in the mid-80s, which sounds ancient, people were telling me, well, you're going to go up there and you're going to get hanged. You don't go up there. You don't go into that neck of the woods, so to speak. So it's an unknown place on the edge that you say, you know what, by sundown, y'all need to be out. That was still going on in people's minds in the 80s, late 80s. So when I started working, people said, well, you're going where? And I'm going to say, I'm going up to Salem. They're like, well, you need to make sure you're out of Salem by sundown. And I remember the first time I heard that, I had never heard of a sundown town before. Went up there to work and didn't think a whole lot about it until I was working a landscaping crew and we needed to get some gas for a mulcher. And I was heading out in the truck to get it. And this dude ran me down, stopped me and said, whoa, 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 I need to go with you. And that's like 88, 89. So that's not that long ago of being on the edge of this place. Now people say, oh, see, that's why I told you not to go up there. When you have a tiny sliver of something, anything within it is sort of concentrated by virtue of that volume. Likewise, the influences from the outside, it's sort of insular in a way. So I'm constantly thinking about that sliver of a place.
So like many of us who are not native to this region, but who, for whatever reasons, have settled here, Drew has come to develop a relationship to this place where he explains that he not only claims it, but it claims him, which I thought was pretty deep.
And to make this point, he shared with us a passage from The Changing Blue Ridge Mountains, Essays on Journeys Past and Present by Brent Martin.
Barry Lopez writes, Brent says, that the effort to know a place deeply is an expression of the human desire to belong, and that the determination to know a place is consistently rewarded. What I appreciate is his insistence that every place is open to being known, and somewhere in this process, a person begins to sense that they themselves are becoming known, so that when they are absent from that place, they know that place misses them. That's powerful. And this reciprocity to know and be known reinforces a sense that one is necessary in the world. That sends chills. I mean, that, you know, Brent is interpreting Barry Lopez there, but that whole idea of being in a place and knowing it. So as a naturalist, you know the soil, you know the ground, you know the plants and the animals, the patterns of weather, and you become comfortable in that place. You know that place. And then this reciprocity begins to happen. So I'm born of the Midlands, but here I am Black in Appalachia and calling myself a Black Appalachian, right? I wasn't born here, but I feel reborn in many instances here in ways. So I've had to think about what home is and what we call home and how place attaches itself to us as much as we attach ourselves to a place. It takes a while. Sometimes it takes, sometimes it doesn't. Well, I don't know what's over that ridge. Or to be out and somebody say, well, you know, of course you know where the sundown town is. Or somebody refer to something as a hanging tree. Well, what does that mean? Well, you know what it means. But then to educate yourself and to understand where you are and that protest that Bell Hooks talks about and that reciprocity that Lopez talks about, that Brent explains, comes through in this protest. You know what? This place claims me. I'm going to claim it. So I used to have this code. I would say, okay, after I see so many of those kinds of flags, you know, at some point I had to give a single finger salute and say, no, I'm not going to be stupid. I'm not going up in the middle of some encampment, but I am going to say, you know what? I have as much right to be in this place as you do. I remember being up in Bluefield. Y'all know where Bluefield is. My wife and I rode up there at night. And so here you are winding back into these places. This was along the Elkhorn and you can't see, but I remember the next day and coming back down to Bluefield. And I saw these people that didn't look anything like I expected people to look like in Bluefield. I'm like, what are these Black people doing here? And then you get down and then you've got a historically Black college. I'm like, in West Virginia, really? Didn't indigenous people avoid West Virginia? I mean, parts of it was too rough. But then that knowing of this place and learning about this place, but then learning that history of bringing in Black folks to be scabs. But again, that was to me inspiring because I'm like, look, we are everywhere. We claim land by deed and title, legacy. But then for the land to claim us and to feel that, when you feel that in your marrow bone, that to me is a sort of call to action that you hold on to it. And that's where part of my reparation comes from. Because look, you're not going to push me out just because. And we've had a history of that, of people saying, well, you don't need to be here. And you look at 1919 and those times when some of these sundown towns were created and people were given 30 days, y'all need to be out of here and never come back. Well, I'm one person, but I want to seek to change that narrative such that narrow sliver of South Carolina that hasn't been occupied by us in certain ways, but has been, to let people know.
So what's interesting about the practice of loving nature as a Black man is that it's dangerous. And also, in his perspective, it's isolating. It's isolating with his colleagues who see him as like, oh, you're a wildlife biologist. Like, you could just be out there. And he's like, well, I'm still out here as a Black man, though. And so that isolation from having that relatability in his field, it's also isolating in how he moves in his career. And it's also just isolating, like, in general, because he's out in nature by himself.
I'm too old now to let a damn flag dictate where I go, because that's the intent. Because as a wildlife biologist, you're not supposed to be afraid to go anywhere. You know, people hear that and they say, well, you're not a real biologist anyway. We knew that you weren't going to be able to do this work. So I never really talked about that to people, really, until I began to write about it. And it took a few years for that to sink in. And then I know a Black biologist named Richard Morton. And Richard has always been a role model for me because we're the same age, basically. But Richard eventually came to be the sort of the chief of that area. And so he was working up in some of these places and had to get to know these people, and they knew him. And so you would have these exemplars that were lighting, these pathfinders that were lighting the path before you. And you look at them and you say, well, I can do that, but why would I? And that's when the land's claim on you comes in. Because if I'm standing up on Caesar's Head, or I'm hiking in Table Rock, or I'm in Jocassee Gorges, jumping off rock or somewhere like that, and I look out, at that moment of looking out over that landscape, over forests and trees and water and peaks and all this stuff, and say, you know what, I feel like I'm a part of this. And that's powerful, to feel grounded in that way and to feel connected. People do vows in matrimony and they talk about not letting any man put a relationship asunder. Well, I have that relationship to land. And if it claims me and I claim it, then we have a relationship that I'm going to work towards. And I'll tell you, even in the little place that I am now, there's a encampment on the other side of the ridge. It's just sort of curious to me because at certain times they put up flagpoles. And this was after January 6th. And I was like, huh, that's curious. And then you see like an American flag, and you see a Gadsden flag, and you see a Confederate flag, and you see a flag with a certain person's name on it. It's like, oh. And so at that point, I had the same feelings that started coming back. And I also started carrying my 357.
That was he said, yeah, that's when he got his 357.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying? We ain't playing out here. We cannot afford to be playing out here. Like,
yeah.
These are life and death moments, right? You can't afford to be caught without protection, can imagine, you know?
So he made a good point of like, oh, he's out here isolated. Like, when you and I are in nature, we're isolated. We want to just go on and do this PSA and say, we keep them things on us.
You gotta keep your things.
We keep them things on us.
Now, so. I ain't keeping nothing.
Well,
but I know people who, you know what I'm saying? I ain't
you
in
got
nature,
people
though.
Who got
I ain't
things.
In nature,
I'm in nature. I'm in nature. I'm out here. I'm outside.
Yes, I stay in the urban centers. I'm not going in those streets. Not going in the Appalachian.
Yes, yeah, so
y'all
you
can
know.
Have it.
So yeah, we talk about the isolation and danger, but we ain't stupid.
Not at all.
Yeah,
not at all.
We've learned.
That's exhausting to have to roll that way. And part of freedom is being able to keep your eyes ahead or look at the birds you want to see or look at the ground and breathe without this.
It's the freedom for Drew.
Indeed.
And it's really inspiring. It's the freedom for me too. And so for the other budding birders out there, we asked Drew about some of his favorite places in the region to go birding. And here's what he shared.
Caesar's Head, which you come over 76 from Brevard, North Carolina, and there's a little park. If you're driving too fast, you'll miss it. You'll be down the hill too far to turn around and go back. But Caesar's Head is a place that I love to go because there are ravens there. And ravens are special birds. They're large, black, intelligent, playful, resourceful. That's what I want to be. So Caesar's Head is great. It's great for peregrine falcons. It's great for spring migrants and fall migrants. And you're standing there and you're looking out over the Piedmont. And one of the spectacular things is that you can hear bird song from the valley below you, and it just sort of drifts up. So that's one of the favorite places. Jocassi Gorges feels like Costa Rica in the spring and summer. And you go down into those gorges, and that's one thing about the escarpments. You've got these deeply incised gorges that are unlike some of the other highlands. And so it's a place that you can go, that I go, that's close by, that feels far away. And that's one of the things that this place does. It's one of those nearby, far away places. The first golden eagle I ever saw wasn't out west. It was at Graveyard Fields on the Blue Ridge Parkway.
That was a wonderful conclusion to talking to Dr. Drew Lanham, mainly because he's a wealth of knowledge.
He speaks so beautifully, right?
It really, like on the Black and Appalachian favorite voices.
He's definitely up there.
I'm putting him up there. I'm not going to throw out a number. You know what I mean? I ain't going to start nothing. Mm-hmm. But like,
Definitely a cool person to meet and to hang out with. I know I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about like what you said, like behind the scenes, he really knows.
He knows
like
his birds.
Work, and he knows his birds.
he knows his birds.
He's able to let that be the language that he's speaking on.
It's grounding language.
Yeah, so we were talking about freedom, liberation. We're talking about safety. You know, there was a lot that we didn't put in this episode because we were trying to keep it concise. But there was a lot that we talked about. It always came back to his birds. Love place in that. Right. And it was not just placed as a specialist. He was placing himself as just a being.
As a human.
As a person. Yeah. And where he was from. And a child of Mamatha. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. It was a great episode. I really wanted to end us thinking about what he said about joy is the justice we give ourselves. I'm keeping that forever with myself and thinking about how we can actually choose. We can choose a justice for ourselves, especially as Black folks.
Even in the little remote places, distant lands in Appalachia, you know, where you might be the one person in your community or wherever. I'm thinking about people that we've met along the way who live in these places that might not be the safest places.
Yeah, right? But joy can come through a love of birds or a flower, or just a nature walk, or you know, something else, a book, many things. And
so shout out to all y'all Black folks in this region who are like the only one in your little area. We see y'all.
We hear y'all. We appreciate y'all because
the birds see you too.
Exactly. And you're seeking your justice through seeking your joy.
Indeed. All right, Pumpkin, let's leave the people with a little bit of a nugget. What are you reading or studying or thinking about anything in particular? Any music that you're, I know that Beyonce album just came out.
Yeah, it is August of 2022. It is post...
Happy Black August, y'all!
Yes, it is Black August, but also it is post Beyonce saying, Pumpkin, I need to just give you this album real quick. We're going through some things. We need to dance.
Good.
Thank you, Beyonce.
Shout out to Beyonce.
I'm listening right now to a lot of Brazilian music.
Okay.
I'm listening to a lot of booty shaking music.
Okay.
I'm moving my body. It's hot in August, but we still doing it. And I'm reading right now. It's not even something deep. I'm reading the Black Hammer series. Okay. It's a comic book series.
Sweet.
Real talk. Sweet. It's awesome.
Okay. Well, definitely want to shout out. It is August. It's Black August. So happy emancipation to all the folks who are celebrating emancipation. Shout out to our folks at the Appalachian African American Cultural Center in Pennington Gap. They're about to celebrate August 8th. All the Black and Appalachian crew will be out there. Probably not me, though, because I'm moving. I'm moving to Saturday. I'm moving to West Virginia. So all my West Virginia folks, what's up? I'm going to be over there in those parts of the world. I've been reading On Rotation. It's a book about a medical student. Very basic, but
yeah, we got some not so that's deep readings, but no,
nothing deep at all.
And also for Black August, definitely to the incarcerated folks in honor of George Jackson and the folks that will never be forgotten and our political prisoners. We think of you, we love you, and we're fighting for you.
All of what she said. Ashe. All right. Shout out to the Black in Appalachia crew. Y'all can follow all of our work at blackinappalachia.org. Also, you can follow us on the socials. We are Black in Appalachia on Facebook and TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and all them other places. And shout out to the Black in Appalachia team, Chris Smith, William Isom, Brent Allen, Pumpkin Star, and everybody else who be doing Black in Appalachia things. Y'all can find me on the socials at Nkeshia Lamine. And yeah, see y'all next time. Bye.
Bye.
From PRX.